So.
Takes a bit of a foundation.
Yes.
A black hole neutron star physics.
I'm sorry for the confusing title. I'd like to thank the organizers, Huan and Haixing and Dennis, for inviting me to come. So initially, Huan told me I can talk about testing fundamental physics, and then I said, okay, I can talk about black holes, mainly the echoes, and also I did some small research on neutron star tidal interaction, and I talked to several people here. I thought, maybe there is something I can add. And then Rana wanted me to talk about displacement noise-free interferometry. So therefore, my talk has three parts. Each part is not very, you will see, each part is not very conclusive. So the first part is about echoes from binary black holes and binary neutron star mergers. If they exist, they would prove the absence of the horizon. But if they don't exist, maybe that sort of proves the existence of the horizon. You know, that's an interesting question. So, and the second part, I will talk about a small portion of the evolution of binary neutron star mergers, basically right before merger and at the end of the in-spiral, where I would like to argue that there's maybe something interesting and also could be motivating some further research, and then it could be good for the kilohertz detectors to observe. And finally, I would talk about displacement noise-free detectors. This was a very old idea many years ago. Maybe this could be interesting again now that we're thinking about detectors that go for higher frequencies. So I think black holes are interesting. One thing is because they're very special. They have this horizon. And the horizon basically is a boundary between the region where you can reach infinity and you cannot. So for a long time, some people thought, okay, if I observe these quasi-normal modes, then I would be probing the horizon. But of course, that's totally not true, because these quasi-normal modes are actually, they probe the photosphere outside the black hole. So what is the photosphere? So I think the most interesting way to understand it is to see that when you take the wave equation outside of a black hole and you take a WKB approximation, you write down the scalar field as e to the is, and in the Acono approximation, you find out that the s satisfies the Hamilton-Jacobi equation for null geodesics. And basically through this process, you argue that the quasi-normal modes basically corresponds to standing waves that sort of travel around these photon orbits outside black holes, which are closed, like they're photon orbits which are on the photosphere. If you're inside the photosphere, the photons would go down to the black holes. If you're outside the photosphere, these photons go toward infinity, and you have these bound orbits on the photosphere, and they correspond to these quasi-normal modes. So basically, the quasi-normal modes are standing waves that sort of propagate around these black holes. So therefore, they don't really have much to do with the horizon. It really have to do with the fact that the black holes are, they have such strong gravity that light sort of circles around them. So therefore, if you see these quasi-normal modes, you can say that, you know, I test some no-hair theorem, but you're really probing the geometry a little bit away from the horizon. You still don't know whether the black holes have horizons.
And is the distinction between photosphere and horizon, is this something that exists or is significant even when the black hole is not spinning? Or is this, you're making a bigger distinction because you're assuming it's spinning?
I think for Schwarzschild, for extremely spinning black holes, they sort of get close in some coordinates, that the photosphere and the horizon get very close. And the quasi-normal mode frequency becomes comparable to the horizon's frequency. But for a general non-extremal black hole, the quasi-normal mode frequency is not the horizon. It's kind of away from the horizon.
Just so we have intuition, like how much percent?
I think it's 3m versus 2m. That's the difference. 3m.
The radius. Yeah, the radius is 3m versus 2m.
Okay, thanks.
Yeah, that's right. For a curve, of course, with you know, you have co-rotating, counter-rotating, they're different. And depending on the inclination angle, they're also kind of different. So yeah, now the echoes are the signatures of the absence of the horizon. You know, what you might think, okay, is there a signature of the horizon instead of the signature of the absence of the horizon, right? Well, of course, you would like to go after a signature of the horizon itself. You would prefer something where if you see it, then you know, oh, there's a horizon. But nobody is able to find it. Nobody, you know, maybe you guys can find it. Now, the second best thing to do is to say, okay, if there is no horizon, if there are some structures, you know, either right outside the horizon, a little bit outside the horizon, then you will see these echoes. I will explain a little bit more. I'll motivate the horizon a little more. But the idea is that if you have some structures right outside the horizon, right outside the horizon, you will see these echoes. And in fact, you know, these guys, they claim to have found these echoes in the, you know, the first detection, the second detection, all the detections, they all found these echoes. They found it, they claim. I'm not going to argue whether statistically they're really significant enough, but I want to argue that, you know, there are reasons to sort of motivate for these echoes. And I don't think they're extremely absurd, you know, myself, personally. So the idea is that if you look at the wave equation for perturbations or gravitational waves outside a black hole, and you can write it down, you can say I do some angular you know, functions, and then I have a radial equation, and the radial equation for the propagation of these perturbations, you have some kind of potential barrier, and then you have a region near the infinity, the wave can go out, and you have this region near the horizon where the wave can also go in. Okay, so any you know, if you have a star, you wouldn't have this region. If you have a star, you would have a centrifugal barrier, you know, centrifugal barrier that just goes up, right? A star basically has centrifugal barrier that goes up for any perturbation. Here, black hole, you have this thing goes up and then goes down, and you have another asymptotically, you know, propagating region where the wave just can go in. And this is the signature of the mathematical feature of having a horizon here. And then, of course, these guys that argued that now if you have something very similar to a black hole from the outside, but just different from a black hole if you have something in here, then what happens is that you modify the potential, you know, at this location, which is very near the horizon. And if you have any modification, of course, what happens to these perturbations is that you get a reflectivity from here. Okay, so that would be some kind of generic feature if you do deviate from the horizon. You have some feature here. Now, let's look at it a little bit more. Let's motivate a little more. What kind of feature can you have? Starting from the simplest type, you can say that, okay, this is the potential barrier. You know, the potential barrier in this radial perturbation equation basically means that the black hole is kind of attractive. So basically, things that try to escape from the horizon get reflected. It just means that the thing fall back to the horizon. Okay, and then, you know, you can say maybe there is a horizon, therefore there is an asymptotically outgoing, downgoing region, but you add some structure. So that's one possibility. You can say that, okay, it turns out this perturbation is not only like this, but there's some kind of thing floating outside of the horizon as a bump, and you can look for this. Or if you say, and this, of course, if you have a wave that is originally coming down from here, is going to be reflected partially. And then you can say that, and that reflection will give you the echoes, as I would argue. So here you can say maybe there's a central object like a gravistar. What is a gravistar? Gravistar is a star that looks like a black hole, but somehow when you're near the horizon, the potential rises up. Basically, you have some kind of object here. Inside here, you can, okay, one model of a gravistar is you have a De Sitter spacetime inside, you have some surface tension here, and then you match to the outside a Schwarzschild spacetime at a certain radius. This is one of the well-known models by Mazur and Motola.
So is graph star stable against collision?
Yeah, it is. It could be. It is, but it violates energy conditions. Because the surface tension is like non-zero, and you know, you have some negative, you have directions where the energy is negative.
So can you work out like the reflectivity based on whatever?
Yeah.
Work out
so it turns out the gravistar reflects gravitational wave not only because it reflects it off here. It's also because the wave goes in and then comes out from the other side. That's actually why you have this infinite potential barrier. It's a centrifugal potential. It's really not the reflection. So there are two types of reflectivity in this radial coordinates. One type is a true reflection out of some structure, and the other type is you go through the center and you come out. So therefore, you have two things. Of course, you know, if you look at all the echo papers, they're mainly like this Schwarzschild kind of model because this curve is kind of hard. But there are some papers where people say, especially from this paper, Nakano and others, they analyzed the version here with some kind of reflectivity and then using the Tarkovsky equation. And then they see something actually pretty weird. So a little bit different. So I don't have intuition, so I would not talk about the spin. But the idea is that you can have some kind of reflectivity, and then from here you can start arguing about echoes. And today's talk, I will mainly talk about having a Schwarzschild spacetime being perturbed by a stationary pattern like this. Of course, you can say that, oh, what if the pattern is not like stationary? What if the pattern changes in time? And then you get complicated features, okay? And then the other thing is, what if it takes the gravitational wave a long time you know, to propagate in the de Sitter spacetime before it comes out? That's another possibility. So there are many ways you can sort of enlarge your echo possibilities. But I will mainly talk about general features of this, assuming that it's a Schwarzschild spacetime with a little bit of additional structure like this. So here is a spacetime diagram. Maybe it is a little bit weird for, but it's kind of not it's. So the idea is that this is a horizon, this is a future horizon, and this is a future null infinity, and this thing here is a constant location, which is the potential peak, and this is the location of the reflecting structure. Okay, so this is like a Penrose diagram. So here, the idea is you have some wave that is originally propagating towards the horizon, and then it'll propagate towards the horizon initially, but it could also be reflected by that structure, and then it could be reflected again by the black hole potential, and then it'll basically do this. So this is in the radial perturbative equation point of view. In the actual, another point of view is basically, this wave goes down the horizon, gets reflected off, so it goes down the horizon, reflected off by the pattern, then it comes out, but it sort of falls back onto the black hole, and then gets reflected again, and then falls back, and basically like this. So you have, the picture here basically seems to argue that you have a bunch of echoes that will come out, because every time it reflects off the black hole's potential barrier, part of it will come out. So you have a bunch of echoes. So you can simulate, you can have some simulation. You can say, okay, let me have a particle that's sort of a scalar particle that goes down the Schwarzschild black hole following some plunge trajectory. And then you can compute the echoes. And then this is the general feature you will get. The idea is that this is the in-spiral part of the wave. And then the first and second and third echo, they all come out. And the feature is that they sort of come out with equal time delay. And the equal time delay is basically the distance between the potential barrier and the structure near the horizon. Twice that. All of these actually turns out to be nearly the quasi-normal mode frequency. And the reason is actually can be motivated in two reasons. The first reason is that the gravitational wave that propagates towards the horizon in a binary black hole merger case is actually mainly triggered when the binary is going through the light ring. So basically, if you have the final, if you think about an emery, if this is the final black hole, if the big black hole, you have a small black hole going like this, when the small black hole is going across the potential barrier, that's the moment when it triggers wave that actually can go down the horizon. When it's outside the potential barrier, the wave it generates doesn't go down the horizon. So therefore, mainly the wave that were initially generated towards the horizon is mainly the quasi-normal mode wave. And therefore, the wave that actually reflected off here and transmitted here are mainly quasi-normal mode frequency. Okay, and this was also emphasized in many of the early papers of these echo proposals, and these were, you know, in the searches, they were using these ansatz, where the, you know, these content is mainly quasi-normal mode frequency. And there's some spread over time that I can explain a little bit more, but mainly if you look at the first few echoes, you know, also their amplitude drops off one after another.
Is there a universal scaling for how the amplitude falls?
Yeah. So there's, you can sort of, okay, I have a formula. It's in the next page, okay, in the next, yeah.
Sorry, on the previous plot, is it expected that the first echo is louder than your merger?
So in this case, I'm assuming the structure is, reflectivity is one. And in this case, the first echo is bigger than the in-spiral part. But if this r is smaller, then everybody gets multiplied by r squared, r cubed, r fourth, etc. So therefore, if the structure is really totally reflective, or if the gravistar is fully transmissive, then you will have an echo which is stronger than the main wave. I can explain why, okay? But it's a crackpot kind of argument, but I'll make it. I think it's a pretty good argument, but so think about why. So suppose this is the potential barrier. This is the light sphere, okay? And then your particle is plunging like this. Your particle is plunging like, okay, your particle is plunging towards the black hole, and then it plunges and then merges onto the horizon, right? And then when the particle is doing like this, the radiation is sort of beamed towards the direction at which the particle is moving. Therefore, I would argue in this crackpot way that mainly the radiation is towards the horizon. So therefore, you find out that, you know, when the particle is plunging, if you compute the horizon radiation, it's actually more than the infinity radiation, if you look at the quasi-normal mode content of the wave. Maybe it's not a good argument, but the computation shows that this is the case. I will show more a model using some kind of a Kluge model using a particle, a plunge orbit. And you see that the wave towards the horizon actually has more energy than the wave toward infinity if you focus on the ring down part. Okay.
So I just wanted to make a comment. So here, I mean, this is a linear calculation, but we know that, I mean, these are not linear. I mean, certainly the merger is not linear, but of course, if you said the amplitude is bigger for the first echo, that would be nonlinear as well.
So yeah.
You wouldn't
really
trust that. Yeah.
Yeah, this is a linear. In which sense, right? This is computed assuming a small black hole plunging into a big black hole, which has this structure outside of its horizon.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a perturbation, it's a linear perturbation of the big black hole.
For extreme mass ratio.
For extreme mass ratio, this is qualitative, this is fine for maybe. For non-extreme mass ratio, I can say maybe qualitatively this is okay, but you know, I don't know. And right now it's not clear there are better computations.
And that second comment is that the reflectivity could be frequency dependent. So
Exactly. So, but the idea is that this wave is mainly the quasi-normal mode wave that goes towards the horizon. So therefore, you really mainly care about reflectivity around the quasi-normal mode frequency blue-shifted towards the local Lorentz frame of that structure. because the structure is near the horizon. So, okay, so the idea is that the wave towards the horizon is mainly crossing the normal mode frequency. And then the idea is that the potential barrier, if you look at the reflectivity of the potential barrier and transmissivity of the potential barrier, and the idea is that all of these echoes, they at some stage they reflect off, then they transmit. So for the wave to show up at infinity, it must be both reflectable and transmissible by the potential barrier. So therefore, this is the region where it is preferable. That's why you cannot have the echo which is completely reflected, because that they will stay in. And you cannot have the echo which is completely transmitted, because that will go out in the first echo. So therefore, for all of these echoes, they're mainly like in the middle. They're mainly just at the frequency which is characteristic of the potential barrier. So therefore, you can sort of argue that these echoes, as long as the reflecting structure is the stationary structure, then the echoes are most likely focused near the quasi-normal mode frequency of the final black hole. So this is the argument, okay? And then, of course, and then the other thing that, which is quite interesting theoretically, which, of course, is that once you have a potential which is null, this is the original black hole potential barrier, and you have now this additional feature here. If you ask, mathematically speaking, what are the quasi-normal mode spectrum of these new space-time, you find out that the mode, there are many, many very, very low frequency modes, because you can have modes which are sort of resonant between this peak and this infinite barrier with many, many, many nodes, right? So therefore, it turns out if you look at the transmiss or the coefficient that multiplies the waveform, the outgoing waveform in the frequency domain, you find out there are many peaks. Okay? And it turns out these peaks are separated in the frequency domain by 1 over the separation of the echo in the time domain. Okay? So it's like a comb thing that in many situations you have. So basically the idea is that you have the first wave, you have the second wave, and you have the third wave. They're all separated by a certain amount of time, which is characteristic of the distance between the barrier here and the barrier here. So this is 2L. And then, so the time domain separation is 2L in these echoes, and that in the frequency domain means you have a bunch of modes whose frequency domain separation is 1 over 2L in frequency. Okay? So therefore, if you look at the frequency domain excitation of your echo waveform, it has many, 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 many modes that are collectively excited in such a way that in the time domain, it looks like this, 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 this. So therefore, it's really, previously we were saying, oh, if you have this compact object, when you have this plunge, you excite the least damped mode. So here is really not the case, because here you are collectively exciting a bunch of combs in such a way that you have the first wave, the echo, the echo, the echo. And therefore, and then the frequency domain structure of the spectrum is complicated. So therefore, in this situation, the time domain understanding is a little bit more straightforward and intuitive. And therefore you have this. So echoes which are repeating naturally corresponds to modes which are separated in this way. Okay, so now I give some better estimates in the in-spiral case, assuming a certain plunge. So here I'm showing a situation where I used my student So Ming used this effective one-body picture. So he basically assumed that you have a particle which is plunging into a Schwarzschild black hole with a radiation reaction force added with the EOB formalism, and then he basically assumed that that particle. Then he implemented the black hole perturbation. You assume the particle is a perturbing source in the Schwarzschild spacetime, with a you know, with a reflecting a boundary here, and then you see what is the wave using black hole perturbation theory. And then what he found out is that you can write down the wave at infinity as the original in-spiral merger ring-down wave plus reflection of wave that goes towards the horizon times a series of this reflectivity of the barrier and reflectivity of the black hole to the nth power. So basically, this one in the frequency domain, basically you have, you know, one reflection, two reflections, three reflection off of the between the barrier and the structure. Okay, so this is what you get. So the Z0 is the in spiral merger ring down waveform. So he's just assuming the simplest model where he has a Schwarzschild black hole and then he has a particle plunging. It's EOB, but really not even EOB because it's just a particle plunging to a Schwarzschild. So this is the in spiral merger ring down wave he got. And this is the Z1, which is the wave in front of the reflectivity of the structure, and then with these echoes. So you can see here immediately that the echo, the wave that generates the echo, is actually bigger than the wave, the in-spiral merger ring-down wave, which I argue, you know, in this way, that you're plunging towards the horizon. Therefore, a lot of the radiation is actually beamed towards the horizon.
But this is a time domain calculation?
This is he did a frequency domain calculation. Yeah.
He Fourier transformed the
source function. Yeah. Yeah. So, and therefore, it's quite interesting because it means that if your reflectivity is one at the frequency of the quasi-normal mode, then the SNR from the echo is bigger than the SNR from the ring down by a factor of three. So it means that using the existing detections, okay, there are two ways to say this. The first way to say is that if you think the existing detection has no echoes, then you can rule out R equal to one. You can say that R is probably like 0.1. And the other way to say this is that you shouldn't be surprised that these guys found the echoes, because the echoes, if they exist, they could be pretty strong, you know? If R is order of unity. If you really believe there's a gravistar in the middle where the wave would just go through, then you should have this peak. So it's totally not surprising if somebody would found the...
I guess Niyash will be very happy.
I'm glad you're not surprised.
Okay.
Yanbei, is there a natural value or a range of values for R? So if we start putting limits on R and we say it's 0.1, 0.01, is there some place where you'd say, okay, what's left is improbable or is, you know...
I think one is the natural number. You know, it just means that the thing goes through the star and emerges, right?
No, but I just say one is not a natural number because it means that black holes reflect everything that hits them. And of course, that's not what we think of black holes astrophysically. So I think it's more of a frequency dependent thing, a low frequency.
But it doesn't have to be reflective because this R is a radial kind of thing. It just means that things will go through the center of the star and emerge from the other side.
But that's so astrophysically we would have seen that if black holes were just perfect.
Well, this is really small because you first have to access this photosphere, because the photosphere itself is so small, you know, you wouldn't, it's not reflection. It just means that things will go through the center, would still come out.
But astrophysically, it's effectively reflection, because if things are falling from all directions, then they're
falling from all directions. Yeah, maybe.
So,
okay.
So I would argue that if...
Okay, that should be... Okay.
I suppose zero can also be a natural number.
Zero is a natural number. Zero or one, but... Yeah.
So is this... What I'm getting at is this falsifiable?
Well, you know, I don't know.
Why don't we survive if we try to constrain it?
I think the current claim detections are falsifiable.
Yeah.
But then, no, of course, and like any other thing, if it's consistent with zero, then it's not falsifiable. So the thing is that, if there is no evidence for it, there is no evidence for it. But currently, there's a lot of papers that claim evidence for it. So that's a case that it would be falsified.
Hmm. So, you know, I think if the structure is stationary in here, it's kind of reasonable to expect that the frequency is the quasi-normal mode frequency, and then you have this scaling. So therefore, it means that for a kilohertz detector, okay, so here I was saying that, you know, for the current detections, you can, if you don't have echoes, they're 0.1, and in the future, you can have much less. And then, you know, you want, if you have smaller black holes, then you would have a higher echo frequency. So for a kilohertz detector, it just means that you're gonna be able to look for these 20 solar mass merger products. Or, you know, as Paolo Pani and Valeria Ferrari have argued, that maybe in the neutron star collapse, you can have black hole and echoes. Then, you know, even these echoes can appear at a few kilohertz. So all of these are candidates. I'm not saying, you know, you can, in principle, these are candidates for these, especially the binary neutron star collapse into a black hole with horizon structure. This will be, you know, candidate to be searched for the in the kilohertz detector.
Can you get a near horizon structure and a BNS collapse and not have the same one in a binary black hole merger?
Yeah.
Wouldn't that introduce some scale in the problem?
You would think that the BNS merger, the neutron stars, the matter would fall in. But the wave would fall in before the matter falls in, right? But you can have a scenario where some matter piles up near the final black hole and the gravitational wave sort of comes in and shakes the matter and gets scattered off, and then... but it'll be...
That's not possible, but so far, every time that people have looked at, there is evidence for echoes with them, so...
You can say that, okay, I think, but every time you see there's echo, it could mean the echo is very strong. It could also mean that your method is like not good, so that you see echo there.
It's an event, so I mean, so
yeah.
It's not that funny. If it's one or two events, that's one thing, but if every single one.
I can certainly be, I mean, the LIGO noise is highly not Gaussian and full of bias.
Yeah.
So the chances of finding, I mean, for 20 years, I've always found signals in there.
Yeah.
Even though there were never any gravitational waves.
But right now that we know there is, right? We know there are events.
But I even found gravitational waves when there were none.
But this is how you characterize the significance. These are only there when there are actual events that are reported by LIGO, not elsewhere.
Yeah, but this is a, sort of a, if it was blind, then I would trust it. But if it's only done after the events have been told, then it's not really statistically significant.
Okay. I don't want to hijack the topic.
Yeah, okay, so...
I still wonder about Eric's comment, that like for the CMB, when the tensor scalar ratio has fallen below 0.01, people would still say it's still reasonable to search for 10 to the minus 3.
Yeah.
Right.
But at some level, if we get to 10 to the minus 6 or something, do you keep on making like a $10 billion experiment to look for CMB gravitational waves? And in this sense, If echo discovery holds up, then great. That's really great. But if not, I suppose there's no harm in keep on searching all the way down to reflectivity of 10 to the minus 5 or something.
Yeah, it would be good to have some models where you have a systematic prediction, I guess. Yeah.
Yeah, but then won't you lose the... I don't know. If your model is too... confining, don't you lose the whole point, which is we would like to discover some unpredicted phenomenon, which is generically like this. In which case, you have to have a wide parameter space to search over.
Yeah. That's another talk.
Okay,
so I want to talk about something else. Okay, as you can see, my first part of my talk is not very conclusive. The second part is even less conclusive. I started doing this mainly... It's a small region of the binary neutron star physics. In the first day, there's already two talks about numerical simulations of binary neutron star mergers, focusing on the, you know, both the, you know, the entire process, and then the post-merger has all the features. So here I have the, you know, I I don't know how to do numerical simulations. So I did some analytic studies. So I was mainly trying to work on this program where you add some semi-analytic corrections to binary black hole waveforms to produce a binary neutron star in spiral waveforms that account for the tidal deformation. So here, you start from this model where you say that the neutron star, in response to a perturbing object, the gravitational potential near the neutron star would have three pieces, the monopole piece, a quadrupole piece due to the neutron star quadrupole moment, and a tidal quadrupole tidal field due to the external object. And here you say that at equilibrium, the neutron star's quadrupole moment is the tidal Love number times the tidal gravitational field. Okay, so here, now if you actually have the other neutron star orbit the neutron star in question, you have a situation where the perturbing potential is time dependent. So in this case, you cannot say that the deformation is just the Love number times the external field. You have to consider the dynamics of the neutron star. Of course, strictly speaking, you have to do a fluid dynamics model of the entire star and see how each element, how they interact and how they respond to the external field. So in this simple analytic treatment, following this paper by Hinder and Flanagan, you actually just consider a single F mode of the neutron star, and then you say that, okay, the F mode, there's also different components of the F mode. There are, you decompose it into five symmetric trace-free tensor bases. Basically, the Q2 and the Q-2 are deformations which are of this shape in the orbital plane. Okay, in the orbital plane is some kind of shape like this. This is the Q2 and Q-2. And the Q0 is some deformation that is axisymmetric around the axes of the orbital motion. So here, mainly the Q2 perturbation is driven by a time-dependent field because this guy is moving around, the other neutron star is moving around this neutron star. So therefore, you have a time-dependent driving. And then, well, typically, the orbital frequency is much lower than the F-mode resonant frequency. So therefore, you have mainly this piece dominates, and then you recover the tidal Love number prescription. But there are scenarios where the orbital frequency becomes large enough, then the dynamics here would matter a little bit more. So I was trying to, my student Kevin Burkett and I, and also Mark Shio and Vijay Varma, we're trying to recover people's results. And then, so what you do, of course, is that if you actually have this situation where the mode is dynamical, you actually have to write down the joint evolution equation for the orbital motion, basically saying that the orbital motion with the monopole piece has quadrupole forces due to the deformation of the neutron star. And the n is along the orbital separation. So therefore, in some sense, the having forces here is basically a conservative force, a central force. But having a V force in this component means that the orbital energy is being injected into the F mode due to this term. So we wanted to see this. And then the first thing to see is to estimate whether the F mode, whether you really reach a scenario where the orbital motion is fast enough so that the time-dependent response of the F mode becomes important. So here, what you compare is the orbital frequency, is the gravitational wave frequency and the F mode frequency. So the, here, I use the universe, I copied formula from this paper, where they use a universal relation between mass and radius and all the quantities of the neutron star. So basically, if you give neutron star mass of 1.4 solar mass, and if you give radius, you know the F mode frequency according to this line here. And then you can also compute, I didn't compute the Roshlov. I was just doing this is the ESCO frequency, and this is the frequency at which the two neutron stars will touch. So basically, the orbital motion doesn't get to the F mode, but it's not really far away that much. So you can see that there's some kind of danger where the F mode becomes more excited than simply the adiabatic tide. So here, we did some calculation, and then we don't have a lot of conclusions, but we think it's quite interesting. So here, I have three curve, I have two diagrams, and the first diagram here basically shows that as a function of frequency, what is the tidal deformation? The in-phase component means the tidal deformation, which is giving you the radial force. That part of the tidal deformation compared with the adiabatic tide. And then you can see that, so here I also consider the spin of the neutron star. So you can see that when the neutron star is not spinning, you can sort of see that that part of the tidal Love number, the effective deformation is almost twice as the adiabatic version. And then in here, I am plotting the angular force due to the tidal coupling into the F mode divided by the angular force due to radiation damping, the leading order radiation, gravitational radiation reaction damping of the orbital motion. And you can see here near the end of this, you actually have a substantial fraction of your orbital energy being damped into the F mode instead of going toward infinity, because your F mode is extracting energy at a rate which is equal at the end to the radiation damping. So it means that your evolution is substantially affected by this F mode pumping into F mode. And I think it calls into question, you know, in fact, when your F mode is excited so much, it's not clear to me that an adiabatic version that was currently being used in the tidal EOB formula is reasonable. I'm still thinking, I'm not sure. But what is more interesting is if you consider the spin of the neutron star. So here, I'm considering two scenarios. The first scenario is the spin angular momentum is along the orbital motion direction. In that case, your orbital perturbation has a lower frequency in the co-rotating frame of the neutron star. So in that case, the tidal effect is, the dynamical tide is not important, and you can see this is a red curve, and you see that the Love number is just the same as the adiabatic one, and there is no energy being injected into the F mode, which is good, which basically means that in this case, you can just use you can just use adiabatic tide. But the other case is when the neutron star is anti-rotating, like neutron star spin is pointing the other direction than the orbital direction. So basically, in the co-rotating frame of the neutron star, the orbital perturbation is faster than the orbital frequency, twice the orbital frequency. And then in that case, I'm assuming the neutron star is at 300 hertz, okay? 300 hertz is not over-rotating the neutron star, but at 300 hertz, you have many other things that are wrong here, because I'm assuming the same F mode frequency, and I'm assuming the F mode is not split. So, but here you can see that the Love number is quite big, and then it becomes negative. So what it means to be negative, it just means that the deformation, at the beginning, the deformation is locked with the orbital motion, and then after a little bit, the deformation becomes 90 degrees away, and then the deformation becomes pi out of phase with the orbital motion. That's why you have a negative tidal effective tidal Love number. And then you can see that the energy is being pumped, a big fraction of the energy is being pumped into the F mode. So I think it just means that it's quite interesting to study this regime where the late inspire of the stage of the neutron star, a lot of things are going on here as well, which may tell you about the spin, about the F mode, et cetera. And these all happens in the 800 to 1 kilohertz regime, which is exactly the regime we're talking about here. So I would like to call the attention to this regime as well. As in the first case, I don't have a lot of conclusions. So finally, can I talk for 15 more minutes? So
we could give you another slot in the afternoon.
If it's 15 minutes, it's fine. If you like, let's say like 30, that's
only 15 minutes.
Yeah.
starting late, so we don't. Yeah.
I want to talk, and then people may give me feedback. Okay, so this is totally different. Totally different. So this is some work that I did with Seiji Kawamura like 15 years ago. Basically here, Seiji has this very good insight that he says, if you look at how gravitational wave enters your signal and how the displacement of the mirror enters your signal, they don't enter the same way. Basically, if you look at the phase of the light at here versus the phase of the light here, they're related by, you know, having a phase modulation due to the location of the mirror at this moment of time. You know, the L is the distance, right? L, this is of C, this is C, 2L over C, okay? So basically, this one is this one at T minus 2L over C plus this location evaluated at L over C plus two integrals, which basically the gravitational wave accumulates, the phase accumulates over propagating in the gravitational wave field, okay? So the idea is that you can actually approximate this as having the gravitational wave displace the mirror only if omega L over C is much less than one. If omega L over C is comparable to one, this one senses the gravitational wave in a different way than it senses displacement. And there's in principle possible to remove your sensitivity to the displacement and then only sense the gravitational wave. Only sense gravitational wave. Now, how do you do this? Okay, so Seiji has this picture, and then he said you can think about it in the following way. So you can draw a space-time diagram. You can say that from here, I send two light pulses, one from here to here, and then one from here to here, and they reflect off of a mirror, or they reflect off of some kind of object at this location back toward here, and this reflect off from this guy back to here. So what you can do is to say, I have a clock here, which travels along this world line. I have a clock here, which travels along this world line. I have a clock here, which travels along this world line. And you're able to read off the time at this location, this location, this location, this location, this location. And then you can also subtract, and they can compute the amount of time or the amount of coordinate time it takes for light to travel from here to here, which is tau bc, and then from here to here, which is tau cb, or from here to here, and from here to here. You can compute, you can measure all the four time intervals. So the usual Michelson interferometer, we measure the sum of these two, basically the total time it takes from here to here, and the total time it takes from here to here, and we subtract these two. Okay, so that's how the Michelson interferometer works. So the Michelson interferometer is not good for displacement, because if you make this mirror farther away from here, it takes more time to travel from here to here, and it takes more time to travel from here to here. Therefore, these two guys both sense the same displacement noise here, and you add them together, you sort of double the displacement noise. So therefore, you sense the motion of the mirror. But you can actually do something different. You can say that, what if I measure this one and I subtract this? Well, when you do this, this becomes longer, this becomes longer, but if you subtract these two, this motion is no longer sensed. And if you subtract these two, this motion is no longer sensed. If you add these two, this motion is not sensed. And if you both do minus, this displacement is not sensed. So at the end, if you do this kind of combination of the signal, you're totally not sensitive to displacement noise. So he gave you an example where you don't sense displacement, but you do sense gravitational wave if gravitational wave changes sign during this time. Okay, so the gravitational wave frequency must be non-zero and preferably pretty high so that the gravitational wave would change sign between these two parts of your experiment when you subtract your signal. Okay, so that's the kind of the theme that you would take. So that clock thing is very confusing. So let's say if you take two beams of light, one beam traveling from here to here, and the other beam traveling from here to here, and you have a moving mirror like this, the strategy to measure gravitational wave but not displacement is you do the both measurements, but you subtract these two. Okay? So you take this signal here, and you take this signal here, and you subtract. Now, if you do subtract, the mirror displacement is not measured, but gravitational wave remains if it comes in from some kind of side, because when you subtract these and that, the gravitational wave, you know, one of them is integrating this way, and one of them is integrating this way, and also you're subtracting this one and this one, so therefore, this one and this one are subtracted at the same time, but therefore, at the same time, you're sensing gravitational wave at different locations. So therefore, as long as your size of the detector is comparable to the wavelength of the wave, you can actually have residual gravitational wave signal. Okay, so this is the idea. But then, back in 2005 or 6, Seiji and I thought, let's think about some interferometer configurations. How do you build an interferometer that has displacement noise-free? And then we came up with these very complicated devices. You know, one example is this, where you have light coming in from here, and Mach Zender, multiple Mach Zenders that cancel this motion and this motion, and you have another Mach Zender that cancel this motion and this motion, and then the dashed and the solid here, they cancel this motion. So it looks pretty crazy. And also, it doesn't have fibrillar cavities, and therefore, you're not able to enhance your sensitivity using resonance.
So this is
not pretty good, not good. And also, then we came up with a three-dimensional configuration. You know, we like to think, but it's not good, not good. Also, it doesn't have cavities. But recently, since we're thinking about gravitational wave detection at the kilohertz regime, and so therefore, omega L over C in principle is not, it's comparable to one for us, you know, in this workshop. So Rana said, maybe we should think again about displacement noise free, and maybe there are better ideas than these two. You know, these two, we were thinking about like space-based detection, so we're thinking about these kind of things. But for ground-based detection, it's important also to have cavities. So I started thinking about this configuration. So basically, the intuition is if you sense mirror with this light and this light, you sort of cancel this motion and you sense gravitational waves. So therefore, I considered a situation where I have three mirrors. One mirror is transmissive, and both are reflective here. And I have a pumping field here, which pumps this loop, and the signal comes out from here. And I have another pumping like this, and it goes like that, and the signal comes out from here. Okay, that's why this pump A1 and signal A1 and pump A2 and signal A2. So I have this configuration, but then of course, if I only have this configuration, I have two output fields, but I have 1, 2, 3 displacement noise signals. So this is not good. So what I did is I said, oh, let me consider this. And then let me also fictitiously say that the next is I make this totally reflective, I make this transmissive, and I have pairs of light coming in from here and coming out from here. And then I have this one transmissive and light coming in from here and coming in from here, coming out from here, coming out from here. So basically, I computed three copies of this, rotated 60 degrees away from each other and somehow screwed onto each other. Okay, so this configuration. So that this configuration, I have 6 outputs because every port I have 2 outputs, and then I only have 3 displacement noise channels. So in principle, I can have 3 channels of gravitational wave data which are free from displacement noise. And then I computed the sensitivity. And then I got very encouraging results in the sense that as a function of omega L over C, I see that my displacement noise-free noise curves Of course, they're worse than my total noise curve without eliminating the displacement channels. But it still has quite good sensitivity near this resonance, this resonance, this resonance, this resonance. These resonances are basically frequencies where 3 omega L over C is 2 pi N. At these frequencies, I have good sensitivity, and the sensitivity between the displacement noise-free and non-displacement noise-free are kind of not so big. And here, basically, the T is the transmissivity of the mirror, of the coupling mirror.
Sorry, so displacement noise-free is short noise higher than the...
Yes, because displacement is only short noise. So displacement noise-free, you cancel your... You have 6 channels, but you eliminate 3. And you only have 3 channels left. Therefore, your sensitivity is worse. Your shot noise limited sensitivity is worse.
What do you mean by non-displacement?
Oh, that means the full shot noise. Means you consider all 6 channels.
Oh.
All 6 channels. So this is encouraging, but at the end, I will say I'm not sure this is good. But,
These dips are like the FSR dips in the LIGO.
That's right. Yeah.
So I've heard, I don't understand this, but I've heard from Dennis that in a Michelson interferometer, it's hard to do control around the FSR.
Yeah.
No?
This is so far out, control is not a problem.
Sorry about it. It's nothing to control.
We talk about the Boston Explorer case, and then if you want to have good sensitivity around FSR, you suppress frequency noise, and there is no signal for it.
Yeah, as you know, like people have talked about this FSR myth for years and years, but in LIGO we get around it because the two arms are slightly different length. If you make them 1 centimeter different, you have a signal for all frequencies.
Well, I mean, we still have a dip of like more than 15 dB.
So what?
So it's, I mean, in LIGO, because we have our bandwidth less than FSR.
Before you came around, we used to have bandwidth more than the FSR by a factor of 2. Just because the arm lengths are mismatched by a centimeter.
Yeah, but still, I mean, your sensitivity there, I mean, what is your sensitivity in terms of...
It doesn't matter. The bandwidth is much higher, so you can have whatever you want.
Well, you see, because in LIGO, again, your FSR is out of band, but you just would be in band and what would be a noise.
You have to do better, but there's no limit to the frequency stability. It's like ELISA. In the ELISA system, they're able to do frequency stabilization well beyond the FSR of the ELISA arms. Mm. It's not a concern.
This is like ELISA, but I would say this is not as good, even worse than this. But yeah. By the end, maybe you don't even want to argue this because maybe it's not so promising.
It's just challenging.
So this is, if I zoom in the noise curve, this is the displacement noise free, and this is the total noise, and there's some small factor. But overall, this configuration seems interesting, at least. But this configuration, you have to remember, is not a physical, it's a more mathematical configuration because I assume this mirror to be fully reflective, and I couple here, and then I have another copy of this where I make this mirror totally reflective, and this one couples, and then I have a final version where these two are fully reflective and this one couple, and I glue all 3 together.
But we can do it for real. We have a whole coffee break.
You can, okay, but then let me show you what the real version is. The real version has this one. The real version, you have actually 3 mirrors like this, and then you have 6 field like this. Then the noise is so terrible. Oops.
Ooh.
Oh.
It destroyed your PowerPoint so bad.
So in this case, somehow these 2 dips don't exist for the DFI, and you only have 1 dip here. Ugh.
I don't understand why you're doing this dip stuff anyway.
This is the noise spectrum.
Yeah, I know, but who cares about these dips? Only if you make these giant Earth-sized interferometers do you care about using the dips.
Oh.
Interferometers of today...
You just use these ones?
...are not at the dips.
If you go back a slide, it was 20 kilometers, and
that's
and
crazy.
It is crazy. That's right.
With 3 and 4 kilometer detectors, the dips have nothing to do with neutron star bombs.
Yeah, if you have 3 kilometers, this is like 6 times, so it's like 12 kilohertz. It's here.
Yeah, but the usual DFI idea is not using the dips; it's just using the sub-dip range.
Yeah, but then you don't have a gain using the cavity, and so therefore your sensitivity is just as if it's a microsystem without cavity.
But it's displacement noise free. That's the point. We're not just talking about shot noise.
Yeah, it is displacement noise free. That's
the thing is we want to be eliminate these nuisance noises.
Yeah.
Shot noise is just squeezing or whatever.
But if you don't have the cavity gain, that's very bad.
No, we have to have cavities.
Yeah, this doesn't, the cavity, if you're below one, that's the cavity gain.
We're going to have to get to a one.
Yeah, it's a, okay.
Oh, yeah.
So yeah. Why is this, so you still have one dip, but why are these others?
So the one dip here has to do with omega L over C equal to 2 pi N instead of 3 omega L over C.
Why? So, like,
I don't know. I did it last night. I don't know.
Why do you want to like have 3 pairs? Like, it sounds like if you have 2 pairs, you can already eliminate 3 degrees.
No. So here, this means I have this one. I have another copy where I couple this one, but not these two. I have another copy where I couple this one, but not these two.
Yeah. So, but each copy has identical displacement noise.
You have 3 displacement noise.
That's not identical. No.
Yeah. So, don't you only need 4 channels?
I suppose then you probably need 2 copies. I agree. You probably need 2 copies. But for the sake of symmetry, I have 3 copies.
Yeah.
But I had higher hope for this one, right? This one is highly symmetric, but somehow when I do this, I found out that the first 2 peaks disappeared.
I reject your whole hypothesis.
Okay. What hypothesis?
This whole dips stuff.
Oh, okay.
I totally reject.
Okay, fine.
So
but
we have no time to reject, so
yeah, sorry. We have to take the coffee break.
Okay, but you see, there's this one. Okay, anyway. But you can do DFI in the ground, I guess.
Yes.
Yeah.
Maybe one more thing. So usually, if you have this kind of systems and you have small signal, then because of the locking behavior, you don't see any signal.
No, you don't have small signal because your signal is actually this big. This is just a combination by data processing. So your full sensitivity is here, actually. You don't really cancel your sensitivity.
Oh, but by small signal, I mean like some significant fraction of lambda.
Some. Because you're saying this narrow line width?
No, I just mean like because it's 2 fields that counterpropagate, so they
kind of
a little bit into each other, and then they walk.
Uh-huh.
So then your radiation wave comes in, and then I think your dips mean that like one wave reflects, one wave changes the phase slightly differently from the counterpropagating wave because of radiation wave. I think that's the case, right?
Maybe, I don't know. I thought the propagating and counterpropagating, they don't couple. Oh, maybe the carrier of one couples to the other one, but the fluctuations don't couple.
Well, the carrier starts off at the same frequency in the beginning, but it's not, of course, we won't use this real triangular thing, but because of the area of the thing, the frequencies will just be shifted by Earth's rotation.
Also.
Yeah, then you start copying noises by Earth rotation, but then
it's not noise. I mean, it's the lock is broken by the Sagnac effect.
Then we should do some other combination, some other configuration where you have zero area somehow. I don't know.
Who cares?
Oh.
Zero area or not?
Oh.
The So Earth's rotation is pretty steady.
No, yeah.
Oh.
Wants to use us.
Oh, wants to use. Oh, okay.
Use us to break this walking.
Oh.
Yeah, then you don't have any cross coupling.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
So how can you do an experiment like this?
We'll have to build a few kilometers. As a prototype, we'll build a 4-kilometer Sagnac interferometer and use it to detect the curl in the gravitational wave field. And then that will be the pathfinder for the 40-kilometer gyro, which we'll use to set up the prototype for the 400-kilometer gyro.
Can I imagine a magneto at gravity?
Yeah.
Gravity's magnetic force, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, so we can find curls.
Anyway.
I'm sure curl in the gravitational wave field is not the most exotic thing being studied in this building.
Okay, so that's it. Thank you.